Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Okay, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. It is Monday, December 22. I'm Kyle Evans. Happy holidays to you all, and thanks for tuning in wherever you are around the Pacific. Coming up on today's show, a seasonal worker is sentenced to 8 years in jail after pleading guilty to the rape of a teenage girl in Australia.
And it wasn't until after the victim had given her evidence to the court that he and his legal team consulted and elected to change his plea from not guilty to guilty.
Also, France delays plans for a referendum into New Caledonia's political future. And a former A-League coach takes charge of a new Pacific franchise ahead of the OFC Pro League. Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's get started. But first, France has delayed plans for a referendum on New Caledonia's political future. The vote was due in 2026, but Paris now says more talks are needed. France was preparing to hold a referendum in New Caledonia as part of its commitments under the Bougainville Accord, which set out a political pathway for the territory's future status. Now, pro-independence leaders warn the delay risks undermining the self-determination process. Joining me now to discuss it is Island Business reporter Nick McClellan. Nick, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Kyle.
So what has the French government said about why the referendum has been abandoned?
They haven't actually said very much. Last November, the overseas minister of France, Naima Mouchou, visited New Caledonia and said that they would hold a referendum in early March. Then the date was confirmed on the 15th of March, 2026. A leak to the French newspaper Le Monde, however, just a week ago, said that this referendum would not proceed. And there's a number of reasons for that. There's been no official statement from the French government about why this referendum will not be held on schedule. But instead, French President Emmanuel Macron has written to key leaders across the political spectrum in New Caledonia, inviting them to Paris for further talks on the 16th of January. This whole thing has been a shambles, and it's highlighted the divisions between supporters and opponents of independence, but also the failure of policy in Paris.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So if Mr. Macron has invited New Caledonian politicians to Paris to discuss a way forward, I mean, what does that signal about France's approach to resolving this political crisis, particularly given the newspaper that you mentioned has reported that no referendum is going ahead?
Yeah, I think it shows a number of features. Firstly, the French government has much bigger problems. Just this week, the French Parliament has failed to finalise a budget for 2026, the French national budget. The Le Cornu government has been negotiating with parties both on the left and the extreme right, trying to get the budget through. Must be done by the 31st of December. And so now there'll be a special law put forward just to keep last year's budget in place so that bills can be paid until early in 2026 a national budget can be finalised. The French government doesn't have a majority in the National Assembly. That therefore reflects on the problems for New Caledonia. Any hope of getting the necessary constitutional and legal changes required to create a new political statute for New Caledonia just can't get through the parliament in Paris. The announcement of the referendum was also seen as very strange when Overseas Minister Mushu announced it, basically the same date for the referendum would be the date of the first round of municipal elections on the 15th of March. But there are two different voting rolls. All French citizens of voting age are eligible to vote for local councils under French law, but any referendum on New Caledonia would be on a restricted electoral roll. So on the same day, different sets of people were supposed to be voting on two different topics. You know, this has all been falling apart, and it's led to divisions, even among supporters of the Bougival process, as it's been described. The independence movement, FLNKS, has fiercely opposed this ever since they criticised it last August. The so-called loyalist parties are obviously very much in support of the idea of creating a state within a state. But other parties that support the broad principles of Bougival have wanted to amend the original text and have voted, you know, abstained in parliamentary votes on this process. All in all, you know, France is not in control of the process. It's facing major domestic problems politically. And the hope that everything will come good in January is, I think, unlikely, given that the loyalists are firmly opposed to any change to the text negotiated last year. The FLNKS, the main independence coalition, is saying they don't want to borrow the Bougival text. It's going to be very hard to reconcile those with one meeting in Paris in mid-January.
Yeah, it all sounds incredibly chaotic. So what's the response to this decision in France been in New Caledonia from both the pro-independence coalition and the loyalist leaders?
The FLNKS, one of two major pro-independence groups, actually sent a delegation to France to meet with French parliamentarians to explain their perspective on what's the way forward. The loyalist parties are anxious. They've written to President Macron saying that they won't accept any changes to the text that was negotiated last July in Bougival in France. So there are pretty irreconcilable positions from both the loyalists and the FLNKS. Other parties are hoping that they can amend the treaty somehow. It's just legally unclear how that's possible. The real problem for Paris, there's a deadline. Elections for New Caledonia are held every 5 years for their local provincial assemblies. They've been postponed three times until June this year. There's no way they can be postponed again. The French courts have ruled that elections for the three provincial assemblies and Congress must be held in June. Without the Bougival process, there's no way of changing the voting rolls, which, as listeners will know, has been a central point of contention, indeed one of the key triggers for the violent clashes that divided the country last year. And the loyalists are very worried that they have to go to the municipal elections in March and then the provincial elections in June using historic voting rolls, different voting rolls for both cases. There's real problems. We may see, indeed, the government in trouble in Paris if it can't get its budget through early next year. So all in all, French policy is failing. There are significant divisions between supporters and opponents of independence, and there's a lack of clarity about the way forward. President Macron hopes this meeting on the 16th of January in Paris will bring people together. I wouldn't bet on it myself.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans and I'm chatting with Island business journalist Nick McClellan about France's decision to put a new referendum on hold. So Nick, how does this latest delay in political uncertainty affect the long-term process set out under the Noumea Accord for self-determination and changing New Caledonia's status?
Well, the Noumea Accord remains in force. People may remember there were three referendums on independence in 2018, 2020, 2021. The Noumea Accord says that after that, all parties must come together to agree on a new political statute. The complication is that the Noumea Accord is entrenched in the French constitution. It has its own provisions within the constitution, and that's unique in French law. To change the Noumea Accord, bring in a new statute like the Bougival Accord, which was the proposal from the French state, you have to change the French constitution. That involves quite lengthy legislative passage through the National Assembly, the Senate, a sitting of both houses of Parliament, and then a referendum of New Caledonians. This referendum that was proposed for March was going to be first before that complex legislative process. All in all, legally, politically, the French government is struggling. Meanwhile, ordinary New Caledonians are grappling with the economic, social, political fallout from last year's conflict. And the elections for local councils in March will give a pretty good indication of the balance of forces between and within each political bloc. Then, of course, the provincial elections will create a new party, a new parliament, a new Congress in New Caledonia, and then a change of leadership in the government, depending on the outcome of those votes. There's months still to go with New Caledonia's future. We'll have to see what happens in Paris as well, because the shockwaves in Paris are sending reverberations halfway around the globe, and people are watching in Noumea the desperation of the current Le Cornu government as it tries to get a budget passed.
Yeah, and it does lead me into my last question. I mean, what are the broader implications for peace, stability and France's role in the Pacific if this process continues to stall? I mean, both for, you know, New Caledonian communities and for regional neighbours. I imagine it's going to have some far-reaching impacts.
Well, one of the real questions is about the economic situation in New Caledonia. There are a number of businesses still looking for reparations after the damage and destruction caused during rioting and clashing in 2024 between CANAC protesters and the French security forces. Earlier this month, the Administrative Tribunal of New Caledonia issued a 28 million euro liability to the French government for its failure to protect a major shopping centre, the Kenouin's shopping complex. The belief that they didn't have enough police on hand to protect businesses that were burnt down. The French government has pledged enormous economic support for New Caledonia, both for restabilising the budget, but also for the crucial nickel industry, which is the backbone of the economy. But those funds are dependent on the budget being passed in Paris. And the 2025 budget will hold in place to keep paying the bills until a new budget can be formed. But people on all sides of politics in New Caledonia are anxiously watching what's happening in Paris. The Le Cornu government's got many problems beyond New Caledonia, and that's causing some anxiety in the Pacific. Of course, elections for the next presidency is May 2027. Some people worry that this mess is going to continue until the presidential elections come at the end of President Macron's term.
Yeah, it's certainly got the makings of a potentially explosive 2026, and we'll definitely have to wait and see what happens. Nick, that's all we've got time for this morning, but thanks so much for joining us on Pacific Beat, as always.
Thank you.
That was Island business reporter Nick McClellan speaking to us there.
Rout Lemonka, Jacob Maguire here from Nisha Daily. Yes, still broadcasting, still caffeinated, and still yapping.
Uh-huh, and I'm Michael Chow, and as we wrap up the year, we just want to say a massive thank you for tuning in.
From Timor-Leste to the Cook Islands and everywhere in between, we hope your holidays are full of good vibes, good company, and a good amount of sleep after a good amount of feasting.
From all of us at ABC Radio Australia, stay safe, stay happy.
And if you're re-gifting presents this year, we promise not to judge.
See ya in 2026.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, a 27-year-old Samoan seasonal farm worker has been sentenced to 8 years in jail after pleading guilty to the rape of a teenage girl in Australia. Angalofa Angalofa was charged in January 2024 over the attack and faced the Coffs Harbour District Court last week. Reporter Jordan Fennell spoke with the ABC's Claire Simmons, who was in court to hear the sentencing.
Firstly, Arawarra Beach is where the rape occurred. It actually occurred on the sand dunes of the nearby beach at Kurindi. But this community was already a bit discontented with the foreign workers who were here to pick the blueberries in our region. We've got, you know, Australia's biggest area of blueberry harvest under cultivation here. And there was a former caravan park that had been converted to worker accommodation. And the workers there were at much higher density population-wise than what used to be a lovely little boutique surf caravan park. So there was already a little bit of resentment towards the foreign workers in the midst of this community. And then this teenage girl, this 17-year-old girl, was raped on the beach one evening and reportedly by a man of Pacific Islander description. And what happened first that was quite upsetting is that they made an arrest about 3 or 4 days after the rape occurred, and that man was then released when the DNA evidence and the phone evidence brought the police around to a different man of Pacific Islander background, who was Agalofa Agalofa, a Samoan national.
And so he was then charged in 2024, more than a year later. We're now at the sentencing. How did that sentencing play out in court that you were at?
Yeah, it's been a really unusual case. So the defendant, Agalofa Agalofa, who's age 27, had a translator appointed by the court for his appearances. So when he was in court, he had that person alongside him translating what was occurring. And it wasn't until after the victim had given her evidence to the court that he and his legal team consulted and elected to change his plea from not guilty to guilty. So that's obviously a very late change of guilty plea, and that only entitled him to a 5% sentencing reduction for that plea. And in addition, earlier in the trial, he had agreed that he was not going to contest his identity as the man who had had sexual intercourse with this girl. So that meant quite late in the piece that the Crown didn't have to present evidence with witnesses and CCTV that he was the man on the beach. So he got a further discount for making that undertaking as well. So all in all, it was a very tumultuous case. But the judge, Michael McHugh, in the Coffs District Court, did sentence him to a sentence of 8 years in prison with a non-parole period of 5 years and 4 months, which takes him as eligible for parole in May 2029.
Now, Agalofa Agalofa came to Australia as a seasonal worker with the PALM scheme, and I understand that during the sentencing, the judge also made the point of mentioning the hardships that PALM workers face. What did he have to say about this?
Yeah, well, this was during the sentencing hearing. So the Crown prosecutor was at pains to talk about the offender's apology letter, in which he mentioned the devil and temptation. And the defence counsel said this was in no way a mental health claim, but in the context of his traditional Christian faith. And now the judge said that that aspect rings true. Referring to the devil rings true. These Pacific Islanders come here working on the PALM scheme, and they are not well off, and the abuses those workers suffer are notorious, but they are very Christian focused.
And why is it so significant that he made mention of this at this point in time?
Look, it's quite timely. Coffs Harbour just last week was the sitting location for a New South Wales parliamentary inquiry into modern slavery. And the area was chosen because the Fair Work Ombudsman has identified this region as a place where over the past 3 years, 62% of employers in horticulture have underpaid their workforce. So we've got a really shabby record of employers not doing the right thing by their foreign workforce under the PALM scheme. And a lot of the blame is laid at the feet of labour hire agencies. And the Modern Slavery Commission heard from a woman called Marlia Sykes, and I believe we've got a little bit of what she said to the hearing to play now.
I have seen the unfairness that they have, the treatments of the accommodations that they have been living in. And sometimes I know that our people desperately need the money to support their families.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that they have to live like pigs. to earn that money.
Mahlia Sykes speaking there at a parliamentary inquiry in New South Wales looking into slavery. Now, I understand that Mahlia Sykes also visited Angalofa's parents twice in Samoa. What does that tell us about the ripple effects of cases like this beyond Australia?
She visited his family in July and also after the first day of hearings in September. And what she said is that his mother is a disabled person. She is reliant on a wheelchair to get around, but in the home she mostly drags herself around the floor. So these are people in very impoverished circumstances who are reliant on young men and young women like Agalofa to send money home. But it has brought the PALM scheme into disrepute because of, you know, that community disharmony we spoke about earlier, but also because, you know, here's someone on the scheme who's been convicted of raping a young girl.
That was the ABC's Claire Simon speaking there with the ABC's Jordan Fennell. It is Monday, December 22, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And if you're just tuning in, France has delayed plans for a referendum on New Caledonia's political future. A referendum had been planned under the Bougainville Accord. However, Paris has decided more talks are needed. Meanwhile, a 27-year-old Samoan seasonal farm worker has been sentenced to 8 years in jail after pleading guilty to the rape of a teenage girl in Australia.
And it wasn't until after the victim had given her evidence to the court that he and his legal team consulted and elected to change his plea from not guilty to guilty.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat, and switching gears to sport now. And with less than a month until kickoff, the inaugural OFC Pro League is fast taking shape. Five Pacific franchises, most of which are brand new, will compete in round one in New Zealand on January 17. The four rounds after that will be held across Port Moresby, Melbourne, Honiara and Suva. Among the most anticipated of those rounds will no doubt be in the soccer-mad nation of Solomon Islands, which will be the home of brand-new franchise, the Solomon Kings. The 23-man squad will make up the first professional sports team in the country's history, and leading them is newly appointed coach Ben Kahn, who joins us on the line now. Ben, welcome to the program and congratulations on your appointment.
Good morning. Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Not a problem at all. Now, I understand the Solomon Kings squad is finalised. Can you tell us, I guess, how it's all come together and where you've recruited the players from?
Yeah, look, the squad was mostly put in place before I was announced, and it, you know, the whole thing was very rushed from the announcement of the teams that would participate to the the countdown to round one. It's been a big rush. So the model early on was very much to go with a strong local base. I think we've got 20 local players in the squad at the moment. We've got one visa player in at the moment, who's Jez Lofthouse from Australia, and we are anticipating two more visa players potentially to land from Indonesia, but those deals aren't yet finalised. It's likely if they don't go through that we'll continue to go with more local players.
Yeah, interesting. So in terms of the local contingent, do most of those guys come from the Solomon Islands national team or local competitions?
Yeah, I think I'm right in saying that all of them have had at least one cap for the national team, and the majority of the team are, you know, regular and consistent national team players. We thought it was important in year one to keep that level of cohesion and bring in players with experience of football at a higher level, to try to get the team and the club off the ground successfully. However, a huge part of the project is the long-term vision and creating those pathways for young Solomon Islanders. While we were recently over there, we had, I think it was 8 young players across the 10 days, under 18 years of age, come in and train with the team. And yeah, it was really exciting to see the potential there.
Yeah, excellent. And are you happy with the talent that you have on offer now that you've got a chance to go over to the Solomon Islands and see them all play?
Yeah. Look, it's there are some really strong players in there. There's a lot of work to be done. They haven't necessarily had the access to the level of coaching and the level of football that they're about to step into. But they're unbelievable people with an extreme desire to improve and work hard and perform. I think we did 8 sessions over there, and it was brilliant. They were an unbelievable group of boys. They understand the responsibility placed on them to inspire generations to come. How competitive we'll be is hard to tell at this stage. But we'll do everything we can to put a team on the pitch that represents the country and the club as well as we can.
You spoke about, I guess, just what a whirlwind it's been since your appointment a bit over a week ago. And like you said, yeah, the season is less than a month away and none of the teams really have had much time to prepare. What's that been like, and has that been concerning in any way?
Look, if you were to be reading, prepare in a textbook sense, it would be easy to get drawn into the concerns of it, but it is what it is, and it's we're looking at the bigger picture, and we're looking at the long term, and we're looking at what it means for the Solomon Islands and for football in Oceania, to make this league a success. Are we going to be as prepared as we'd like for round one? Probably not. That's the reality of it, but that doesn't mean that we won't give everything, and the players are, really, really hungry, and they're doing everything they can to pick up and learn as quickly as possible.
Yeah. I mean, you've spent a lot of time, I know, in the Australian football system across the A-League and National Premier League and places like that. Given where teams like, the Kings and Vanuatu FC are starting from, do you think they're going to have the talent and the infrastructure to compete with the likes of your South Melbournes and your Aucklands off the bat, or do you think there's going to be a pretty big learning process, I guess?
It's really difficult to tell because, teams like South Melbourne will face their own challenges because they're balancing participation with balancing the participation in the National Premier League as well. Mm. So there's squad depth issues, there's travel issues, etc. So, I think each club will face their own challenges. It's probably fair to say that the more established clubs will be ahead early on. I think just in terms of having the time and the history together that they've had, and potentially the resources to expedite things a little bit. Having said that, our camp in Honiara was fantastic. The facilities were excellent. Everybody at SIF, Solomon Islands Football Federation, were fantastic and embracing the need to step up and drive the professionalism. And I was surprisingly really, really impressed with the infrastructure and the professionalism around it, and how much everyone was working together to try and build something good.
No, I've seen the talent firsthand in the Solomon Islands, having been lucky enough to attend the Pacific Games a few years ago. And yeah, look, some of the talent they've got there is quite eye popping. I found it interesting what you said a second ago about some of those established clubs and the depth issues they might have. Do you think it's potentially likely that your teams like South Melbourne might use the Pro League as like a development pathway for some of their second string guys, or do you reckon they're likely to play their top guys in the Pro League?
Look, I certainly can't speak on behalf of any of them because the honest answer is I don't know. Mm. But what I'm hearing and what I imagine will happen is they'll take the Pro League very seriously, and I think that will be their primary competition.
I see. Now, the Kings, I know, are lucky to have some help due to its partnership with the Wynnum Wolves, who I understand are assisting with building a talent academy and to ensure the flow of players and things like that. So what will that look like going forward?
There's been a long-standing relationship in history with Wynnum Wolves and football in the Solomon Islands. There are many, many Solomon Island footballers that have played for Wynnum over the last sort of 20 years or so. So that connection exists and is strong. Where it lands today is that we will share resources. So the players actually arrive in Brisbane on December the 28th, and we'll train here until we fly to Auckland on January the 15th. So there's, you know, opportunity for, you know, even further resources and facilities. Obviously, we, you know, the technical side of it, Richard Greer, who's Wynnum Wolves football director, has come on board as our assistant coach for Solomon Kings. Rabbi Crayham, who's the president of Wynnum Wolves, is also, you know, strongly involved and on the board of Solomon Kings, and he's helping to he's you know, helping with SIFT to drive things behind the scenes and bring the club up to scratch on a business level. So look, it's a partnership that extends beyond the pitch. Obviously, there's the technical side, but we're all working together, and it's a joint effort to create a strong and sustainable professional football club.
Yeah, I imagine it will take some time to build an academy. But I guess in the meantime, you know, will a team like the Wolves potentially offer, you know, pathway opportunities in the NPL for developing players for the Solomon Island guys to go on playing, I guess, while they're sort of waiting to make an OFC Pro League debut?
It's certainly an avenue that we're serious about and, you know, really exploring. There are some issues there. So Solomon Islanders are classed as visa players for the Australian NPL. And there are obviously restrictions on how many visa players each club can have. But there are, look, there'll be opportunities for sure. And whether that's some of the better players going back to Wynnum potentially on loan at the end of the Pro League season, or whether that's young players from the sort of 16s, 17s, 18s, 19s in Solomon's to come and play maybe under 23s over here. They're all options. Nothing is sort of concrete and finalised, but we're exploring ways that we can give opportunities both ways.
And what about for you personally? You're a journeyman within the football world. Will you live in Honiara and things like that? And I guess how will this shape your life for the next, you know, foreseeable future?
We'll be based in Brisbane primarily when we're not in circuits in the season, because the format of the competition means that you're kind of 10 days-ish at a circuit, play three games there and then back to your training base. We'll primarily be based in Brisbane. There's a big block in Honiara in the middle. It's a lot of travel. I'll be mostly on the road in the circuits. And, you know, when we have the opportunity to come back to Queensland, that's fantastic. It's where my family's based. And that was a big part of taking this job, was to give us some structure and stability over, you know, hopefully a prosperous and longer period. You know, traveling every year and living in different parts of the world is tough.
Yeah, no, I can only imagine. And just finally, Ben, because we are running out of time, but, you know, I guess the A-League is probably a good competition to compare the OFC Pro League to, because, you know, I guess it's had its ups and downs over the years in terms of attendance, commercial viability of certain clubs and things like that. I guess Western United is a case in point, you know, quite somewhat recently. But I guess the speed at which the OFC Pro League has been built, it has been quite fast. Just as someone who's been around football for a long time, does that speed sort of, do you have concerns about the long-term viability of the competition, or are you sort of confident in I guess the appetite for this sort of competition that it can sustain itself?
I think that I can only go off my experience in Honiara in the last 10 days, and the appetite is humongous. I can't speak for the other clubs and nations, but I know that this is a really serious project. Everybody involved is desperate for it to succeed and is confident it will. That relies on, you know, having a good product. It relies on good business in the background. I haven't seen any concerns. Obviously, when it all came about, there were lots of things being said. But I'm of the belief this competition and our club will be around for a long time, and I think it's really exciting for everybody in the Pacific region and Australia.
Yeah, I'm excited too, and I find them, and can't wait to see a few games when it comes to Melbourne in February, and yeah, hopefully meet yourself and a few of your team members in person.
Yeah, that would be great. Look forward to catching up.
Fantastic. Ben, thanks so much for joining us on Pacific Beat today, and good luck with the start of the season.
Thank you very much for having me. All the best.
That was newly appointed manager of the Honiara-based Solomon Kings, Ben Khan, who will lead the side into the historic OFC Pro League season next month. That will kick off on January 17 in Auckland, with the Kings to play their first game against Takata United on Sunday the 18th. To netball now, and the rapid rise of Tonga's national netball team and the recent success of Samoa's national side has been the result of searching the diaspora in Australia and New Zealand for the best players with heritage connections. The strategy worked wonders for Tonga Tala, who won the first four Pacific Oz Sports netball series before Tifa Moana stepped up to seize the crown for Samoa this year. But amid all that success, there have also been concerns about what needs to be done to grow and develop more local players. In response, Pacific Oz Sports have introduced a new competition with the Netball Challenge, designed exclusively for players based in the islands, with Fiji, Papua New Guinea and the Cook Islands all due to take part, as well as Tonga and Samoa. The chief executive of Netball Samoa, Justine Samu, says the impact on the game in her country can be transformative.
Oh, it'll have absolute huge impact. Pacific Oz are now listening to what we're saying as organisations, but we've also had to listen to what our people have been saying. And that's really where it's come about, where the people are saying, you know, where's our development? Where's our pathways? And for them to now see something, and especially off the bat, we just took a development team, which is our first Samoa national development team. They just came back from Melbourne and took part in the Melbourne Pacific Netball Cup. So this, now that they can see there is a pathway, this is not only going to retain, but it's going to re-engage a lot of the players that have kind of dropped off because either they didn't see the pathway or they just weren't aware that there is a potential pathway for them to develop further within netball in Samoa.
I note you say that you believe this will reignite the passion for netball among young girls. So the hope is, I presume, that with this tournament being created, that young girls will go, yeah, I'd like to be part of that. And so there'll be more of them playing at school, more of them playing at youth level, and all the way up to the top.
Absolutely, because something that I know happens here as well as in the other Pacific nations is by the time girls get to secondary school, they start to drop off, especially towards the last couple of years before they enter into university, because the focus has to be academia. But it's not just that. There's also the family commitments that they have, you know, as to my Samoa, that you're expected to assist with the household. Whereas for boys, it's always been easy. It's easy for parents to look and see, oh, well, there's a pathway for rugby, just that assumption because rugby's so big, but they don't see that so much for netball. So I think now when they start to see that there is opportunity, it's not just going to also re-engage these girls and get excited and want to stay with netball, but it's going to open their families to the idea. You know, there are opportunities for players in Samoa, and not just players, also for the development of management. It's not just players that are local based, it's also a full management team too.
Looking ahead 2, 3, 4 years, is the plan that some of these girls that will take part, some of these young women that will take part in this challenge tournament, will eventually move up to the senior national team?
That is the goal, and that's how we are approaching this challenge series. That's why we took a development team over to Melbourne, and it was an invitational tournament, but it was to get our local players exposure to what it can be like, to just introduce, actually, look, this is an opportunity. And as it feeds in, and they can see now there's a challenge series, that they understand that there's a commitment that needs to be given from their end for them to be able to develop, as we try and bridge this gap between our local development and the development that we have overseas, so that we can actually increase our local numbers within the national team. That's actually one of my focus points, is to have more locals within the team, but have them because they're all at the same standard and we're not trying to do two different levels to enter a team. You know what I mean?
The fact, though, that the challenge will be played in Australia, in Brisbane, is that a downside in a way? I mean, I assume you would love to be able to host this tournament in Apia, and of course, your counterparts around the Pacific would love to be able to host it in Suva or Port Moresby or Nuku'alofa or Rarotonga.
We spoke about it. All the countries spoke about it, and we discussed what our capacity was. And yes, I would love to, but with all the other things happening for Netball Samoa in country, we just don't have the capacity to be able to host, not at this stage. But whilst we aren't ready this year, we'd hope to bring something like this to one of the Pacific nations in years to come. But we also spoke about, for these local development players, something that's quite big for them is actually being able to travel outside of their home country. So we thought it will be a big thing for them to be able to go play in Australia in the Nissan Arena, giving them the same experience that the national teams get for the countries.
I'm thinking that on the one hand, the players who are picked to represent Samoa in this new tournament have a chance to put themselves in the shop window. But I guess that might not be a bad thing, because what you might end up with here is something of a conveyor belt. Players will be spotted, players will prove themselves, they might move on to play in New Zealand or Australia, and then another rank comes up behind them. Is that what you would like to see?
Oh, absolutely. When we went over for the World Youth Cup in Gibraltar, I explained to our players there that you come representing Samoa, but we also support the opportunity that you will be seen, that you may get another offer, whether it's through New Zealand or Australia, and we still continue to support their development. And we would still welcome them back if once they choose to come back and represent the nation. And that's our hopes for this development team, that this further exposure will present possible opportunities for them to be seen. So that if it does go that way, and maybe there's an opportunity for a sports scholarship or opportunities that we can connect with other clubs, that can only be a win for us, because a win for an individual is still a win for the country.
That was Justine Samu, the CEO of Netball Samoa, reflecting on what she believes will be a big step forward for netball development across the Pacific. And she was talking with Richard Hewitt. And the inaugural Pacific Oz Sports Netball Challenge starts on November 23rd next year.
Celebrate this Christmas Eve with a Pacific Christmas, featuring the uplifting voices of the Pacifica Victoria Choir. Enjoy a magical evening of traditional and island-inspired Christmas songs ready to light up your Christmas season. A Pacific Christmas, 5 p.m. PNG time, Christmas Eve, and also on Christmas Day at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat, and we're going to talk some science now, because a new study shows Polynesian seafarers migrated in search of water supply, food and agriculture some 1,000 years ago. Their migration from Samoa and Tonga in the west to Tahiti in the east closely followed rain systems which tracked east over time. So how did researchers come to this conclusion? Well, they came to this conclusion by studying plant wax trapped in ancient stone. Joining us this morning from Mexico is Dr. Mark Peeple from the Southampton University. He was part of this multi-university study. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. Great.
Not a problem at all. So what is the South Pacific Convergence Zone, and why is it a key part of this research?
Yeah, so the South Pacific Convergence Zone is one of the main precipitation bands that exist on planet Earth, the second largest actually, and it covers a vast tract of the central and west Pacific, and it provides precipitation for millions of people currently. So it's a huge, hugely important rain band. So we know that this rain band moves today. It moves with the ENSO cycle, so El Niño, La Niña. But we wanted to understand how it moved in the past and how it might have impacted people thousands of years ago. So that's what motivated our study.
So let's talk about the plant wax trapped in ancient stone. How did you find that? And I guess, yeah, how were these sediments discovered?
Yeah, so this plant wax is really, really awesome. So every plant is covered in plant wax, especially the leaves. And when the plant dies, this plant wax actually gets preserved over millions or thousands of year timescales. And it's one of the last things which is preserved from the plant. So when the plant dies, this plant wax enters into the sedimentary record. So that could be rocks or sediments. So we have to drill down, collect the sediment. In this case, it was peat. And then we extract the plant waxes using this big espresso machine, basically. And then we measure the chemical structure of these plant waxes. And then we can tell whether there was a lot of rain or not a lot of rain based on this chemical signature from the plant waxes themselves. So it's a very powerful technique to work out past precipitation.
Yeah, it sounds like something out of Jurassic Park or something, to be honest. And how were you able to find out about the rain patterns?
Yeah, so We traveled to Tahiti and to Nukuhiva, an island in the Marquesas in French Polynesia. We extracted our plant waxes and we measured their isotopes. And we found that actually from 1,000 years ago to the present, there was an increase in precipitation in the east, in the east of the Polynesian islands. And looking at previous data from other plant waxes and other climate data, we found that it got drier over this time period. So based on this dryness in the west and wetness in the east, we came to the conclusion that there was this like push and pull factor which might have occurred and influenced the behavior of ancient Polynesian seafarers to migrate to the east as the rains moved. So basically just chasing the rain in search of better opportunities.
Interesting. So is it fair to say that early Polynesians were rain chasers, I guess, you know, in a search to seek out dependable water, you know, to supply their communities with agriculture?
Exactly, yeah. So some of these communities were very sensitive to changes in precipitation state. So if there was a prolonged period of drought in the west of Polynesia, and there was an increase in precipitation in the east, then that change would have really influenced their behavior to find better opportunities for agriculture, for access to fresh water. It was a very important change which occurred. Yeah.
Wow. So the situation that Pacific countries faced 1,000 years ago, how does it compare with climate change now, particularly with the Pacific? Can you draw a parallel?
Sure. Well, we know that lots of Pacific islands are currently under threat from global warming, principally through rising sea levels, which are inundating some low-level islands. So that's one of the most direct threats. But our study also provides some context for what might happen in the future. So we have demonstrated in our study that the rain band, the South Pacific convergence zone, is actually very sensitive to the temperature of the Pacific and the temperature differences between the East and the West Pacific. So if we have a change in this temperature gradient in the Pacific going forward with global warming, it's likely that this rain band will move again. Now, we don't have very much information about how the temperature of the Pacific might change. It's very controversial and lots of strong opinions about it, but it's not exactly clear. But at least our study gives a strong impetus to really work out what will happen to the temperature of the Pacific, because we know it will have a big impact on our understanding of where the precipitation will move going forward.
So it sounds like they're important for not only better understanding Pacific countries, but also, I guess, what they're going through in terms of climate change.
Yeah, quite right, yeah. And climate change is having impacts right now. So countries are feeling less rain in some islands and more rain in others. But the long-term impact of global warming and climate change is still unclear. So our study really does kind of lay the groundwork and highlights how important it is to really understand how the temperature will change, because this will obviously have a big impact on the rain band, which is, you know, people rely on this for access to fresh water and agriculture. It's crucial for people's livelihoods. This provides great context for work going forward.
And just finally, what are the next steps with this study and I guess what will you use the data for?
Yeah, so we know that the rainfall changed in these islands. We know that it got wetter in some islands and drier in others. But I think going forward, we really want to understand the thresholds that are required to cause a change in a society. So how wet will it have to be precisely in terms of, you know, millimeters per day? How wet will it have to be to cause a big shift, a big migration? Or how, you know, if you have a drought, how prolonged a drought would you need to be to cause a large impact in a society, which might then lead to a migration? So we really want to kind of drill down from this big spatial scale and look at individual islands and understand their sensitivity to climate change. So that's what we're aiming to do going forward. Yeah.
Oh, it's fascinating stuff. And look, I really do wish you the best of luck with that research project going forward, and can't wait to hear the results. Dr. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today on Pacific Beat.
Great. Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem at all. That was Dr. Mark Peeple from the Southampton University. And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat today. Recapping our top story, a 27-year-old Samoan seasonal farm worker has been sentenced to 8 years jail after pleading guilty to the rape of a teenage girl in Australia.
And it wasn't until after the victim had given her evidence to the court that he and his legal team consulted and elected to change his plea from not guilty to guilty. guilty.
I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. at PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. That'll be with Richard Ewart. Stay tuned, though, on ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nija Daily. You'll find all our top stories on our website. Just type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. My name's Kyle Evans. Have a fantastic day.